Welcome to the Up in the Air Sports Podcast. I'm Ben.
I'm Drew.
And today this will be our pilot episode, and we will be discussing the NBA, sort of our playoff picks, and then also going through sort of our very own NBA award ceremony. So I guess I'll kick it off with my NBA championship pick. And you know, recently it's sort of been a toss up between the three teams for me: the Lakers, Clippers, and Bucks. And I sort of eliminated the Lakers from that bunch. I can talk about that a little later if you'd like. So really, for me right now, it's between the Clippers and the Bucks. But if the two teams were to match up in the finals, which is pretty likely, I think I would take the Clippers, because I do think the Clippers do match up better. So that's just my two cents there. So currently right now, I'd say my championship pick is the Clippers. But if you have the Lakers or Bucks, I certainly wouldn't have any problem with it. But yeah.
So Kevin Durant recently made that exact same pick, actually. He said, and I quote, this is per ESPN, if I had to choose, and I hate doing that expletive because you never know what can happen. You've seen that with us last year. But if I had to choose, I'll go with Clippers and Bucks for the championship, and I'll go with the Clippers. And this is my pick as well, mainly because I don't think there's a team this year who can outlast the Bucks in a 7-game series. I guess maybe the Raptors can take it to 6, maybe the Celtics to 6, and that's a hard maybe there. But quite frankly, I think the Bucks are probably going to blow past the entire Eastern Conference this year. And on the Western Conference side, I also have the Los Angeles Clippers, because I think the conference finals in the Western bracket is going to come down to the Battle of LA. And I think the Clippers are a bit more of a complete team than the Lakers this season.
I agree. So, adding on to both your points, I guess, starting off with the Bucks point, how, you know, you think they'll roll through the East. I could see the Celtics possibly having a matchup problem in terms of the Celtics offense and the Bucks defense, at least the way the Bucks play defense. It kind of favors teams like the Celtics, Rockets, and Clippers, to an extent, I would say. But I think obviously Boston, even though they do have a good paint defense, like, they're not stopping Giannis without giving up threes. And obviously, we know how good the Bucks shooters are. As for Toronto, I mean, obviously they have more of the personnel to stop Boston, or to stop Milwaukee. And we saw it last year, but I think there was definitely a bit of a luck factor in that involved for sure, especially considering Milwaukee shooters were bricking. Middleton did not have a good series at all. I just don't really see that happening this year, realistically, even though, you know, of course, anything's possible. And Toronto's offense is also a bit worse this year as well, and I don't see them exploiting the Bucks' defense at all. I'd go Bucks in, like, maybe 6. I think that's a reasonable amount of games.
Toronto, right?
Yeah, against Toronto. Celtics, yeah. Celtics, like, 5-6, too, I'd say.
Yeah, and, like, with the Celtics pick, by the way, that's incredibly volatile, especially considering how, I guess, out of playoff shape they've looked. I mean, you have Jason Tatum, who has not played well at all coming out of the bubble. And if the Celtics are going to get anywhere in the playoffs, that's got to change. Like, I heard he went, what was it, 1 of 18
in the first game? Well, I mean, yeah, technically 1 for 18, but there was a goaltending call. It was like a tip-in. It was a tip-in, so, by the opposing team, so. It was so he technically did go 1 for 18. But my counter with that would be since that game, the first game against the Bucks, he's played well. I mean, he dropped, like, what, I'm pretty sure 33 the next game, correct me if I'm wrong. And then he's been efficient the two games after that as well, even though he hasn't had as much high volume, especially against the Nets, since he didn't really play as many minutes due to foul trouble. But he's been really efficient. He's been attacking the rim well, which is something one of his weaknesses, I'd say, and especially in terms of scoring. Probably his biggest scoring weakness was his finishing. He's been finishing well since that game. So I think for Celtics fans, that is like a ray of optimism, I guess.
Yeah, and speaking of, I guess, that ray of optimism for the Boston Celtics, let's go a little bit more in depth with how specifically the Celtics are going to match up with the Milwaukee Bucks in, let's say, I don't know, a Western Conference semis. Like, how exactly would you see that series going? I know you said 5 or 6 games, but from a matchup standpoint, how exactly do you envision that?
All right, so I think from a matchup standpoint, I think, even though the Bucks do definitely favorably match up on the Bucks offense, Celtics defense end, I think that's kind of a trade off in a way, because I think the Celtics match up well against the Bucks defense offensively. And here's why. So starting off with why, I mean it's kind of clear why the Bucks match up well against the Celtics in terms of their offense, I think, just because the Celtics don't really have the paint presence to stop Giannis. We saw Giannis go off last year. He went off this year against the Celtics in that bubble game. And, you know, if the Celtics do want to crowd the paint, obviously he can just kick out the shooters. So, I mean, it's just not a good matchup for them there. But the whole Bucks defense is oriented against playing drop in the pick and roll and essentially blocking off everything at the paint, just making sure no rim shots are allowed at the paint, and settling for threes from average to, I guess you could say average to mediocre shooters. They settle for those threes. Of course, they settle for threes from bad shooters as well. But the thing with Boston is that, you know, who is Lopez going to play off of? Because you can say he's going to play off of Tice. And, I mean, that's true, right? Because Tice isn't the best three-point shooter in the world. I would agree with that there. But I think in the pick and roll, Tice can pick and pop well enough that I think he can make you pay in that regard. And obviously the rest of the Celtics lineup is shooters. And if they want to go small ball, kind of like Houston, some of their lineups, they obviously have the lineup to do that. You know, Smart, etc. Replacing Tice, I guess, in that starting lineup role. Even though Smart isn't, I mean, Smart actually has turned into a great shooter this year, I'd say. So I think it's interesting how they'd match up there, especially with the Bucks being so defensively oriented in terms of having Lopez, or one of the Lopez brothers at least, whichever one's in the game, play drop coverage at the rim. And I think it's interesting to see how that dynamic will work, especially like in a pick and roll sort of setting where Lopez will have to sort of be forced to choose. I just think that will be interesting.
So pretty much Milwaukee has the edge in rebounding, and their play style revolves around getting average to subpar three-point shooters, giving them the shots, and saying, okay, we're going to live with these lucky three-point shots, but we're not going to let Boston get to the rim.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Tice, actually, I wouldn't call him, like, mediocre, maybe, but he's not a great three-point shooter at all. Probably like an average three-point shooter, I think that's fair. But the thing of Boston is that, you know, it's oftentimes not Tice playing the pick and roll, because oftentimes it's like Tatum and like Hayward. Hayward's a really good pick and roll passer. Marcus Smart's an elite passer. I think that's an underrated aspect of him. So
Right, because I think the one glaring issue Boston has in this series is matching up against the size. Because you already have Giannis in Milwaukee. You have both of the Lopez brothers, like we've already mentioned, and around that trio, I guess you have a bunch of guys who can pull from three. Mm-hmm. So you've already kind of lost the edge in terms of rebounding, because the tallest player on Boston is Taco Fall, listed at 7'5". I'm reading it on BasketballReference.com. However, I don't think Taco's going to get very many playoff minutes, and outside of him, the tallest man on that roster who's going to get significant time is Enes Kanter at 6'10". So I don't think that particularly matches up well against the likes of, let's say, Giannis and the Lopez twins, especially when second possession shots matter so much in today's NBA.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do have the Bucks in like 5 or 6, like I said, but I just do think the Celtics will be one of those teams that are able to sort of exploit the Bucks defense in a way, just because, especially in the pick and roll, they're definitely one of the teams that run pick and roll the most, I think. So Lopez will sort of have to be forced to choose, especially considering if it's like maybe like, you know, Tatum, who can just pull up from mid-range. If he's the pick and roll ball handler, he can pull up from mid-range, or he can pull up from three. And Lopez will have to be forced to choose, you know, do I play drop coverage, or do I let Tatum abuse this mid-range? Or, you know, even if Tice traditionally is a player that I guess the Bucks would let shoot, just because he's like an average three-point shooter, maybe slightly above average for a big. But the thing is with, like, I guess the thing is there is just that, I mean, this, how do I explain this? I guess the thing with Tice that sort of makes it different from like other bigs is just because he's not like that player that's going to be so engaged in the offense. Like when you're giving up those mid-range or 3-point shots, it'll be more to like Tatum or like Hayward perhaps, or you know, Hayward's deadly from like the free throw range. Like when he's shooting mid-range from like the free throw, he's really good from there. So yeah, I just think it'll be interesting there. So that's my 2 cents, I guess.
Right. And one thing I see on Boston's roster is, I guess, a bunch of guys who can make their money from mid-range. And I think that's one really important component of what you just said. Either Lopez twin is going to have to choose, right?
Uh-huh.
You either take the big or you come out to near the free throw line and contest the mid-range shot. So Boston's going to have to hit their mid-rangers. I mean, you got Kemba, you have Tatum, you have Brown, you have Smart, Hayward, obviously. Like, all those guys can really hit their mid-range shots. And if Boston can do that, I think they can prolong the series, but I still think Milwaukee takes it just because of overwhelming advantage everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I agree. 100%. I agree there.
So I just wanted to take one final look at, I guess, Milwaukee matching up with another quote-unquote contender in the Eastern Conference. Let's talk about Toronto for a little bit, actually, because many project them as, I guess, the second-best team in the Eastern Conference. So I'm curious, once again, from a schematic standpoint, how do these two teams match up and all that?
Honestly, with Toronto, I think they do match up pretty well, especially since I think they, out of any team in the NBA, they arguably do have the best defense to stop Giannis, just because, obviously, of their personnel, just because they do kind of play the Bucks style of defense, and theoretically, against such a paint presence, you know, them and the Bucks being such a team that shoots so many threes but also is so effective at the paint, that should work. But my one thing with that is that Giannis is just so dominant. Like, he shoots upwards of 70% at the rim, something like that. He's just so dominant that, I mean, you even with the personnel they have, they still have to maybe overly commit, overly help in the paint, and that's still going to lead to wide open shooters. And I just think if the Bucks make their shots this year, which they didn't really exactly do last year in those last four games, and sort of get a bit luckier, considering I think you could call last year they got unlucky, especially considering since like shooting is sort of has like a hot does have a hot hand factor. I think of that. I just project Milwaukee to win, and I think defensively, Milwaukee's still going to do their thing against Toronto. I don't think Toronto matches up particularly well against the Bucks defense. So I'd say maybe I do say Toronto does better than Boston, just because I do think Toronto's a better team, and I do think they still match up better. Just because even if Boston's, I think, even though they might match up well offensively against Milwaukee, I don't think it's that significant, honestly. So, yeah.
I'm actually going to need some context for my next point. Mm-hmm. How exactly did Toronto contain Giannis last season with Kawhi and Gasol, obviously? Because I remember hearing something about double teams near the paint and forcing him to give the ball up. Can you go in depth a little bit about that?
Sure. So, first of all, they did make him less efficient. He wasn't... I can, like, check the stats last year. I'm not exactly sure how well he did from efficiency off the top of my head, but I mean, obviously they can stop Giannis's efficiency just because of their personnel. But Giannis is obviously still one of the best playmakers in the NBA. I would go as far as calling him an elite playmaker. So essentially, when he passes out to like a wide open shooter, especially considering the Bucks personnel shooting wise, you'd expect the shooters to make their shots, which they did not do against Toronto necessarily. Especially Chris Middleton, he did not have his finest series at all, considering his past success in the playoffs. And that's essentially what Toronto did, to put it very simplified, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to... This is a surface-level stat, obviously, but just for context, Giannis shot 44.8% from the field overall, and Chris Middleton shot 41.1% from the field against the Raptors last season. So, like you said, once again, not the best series. And for more, Bledsoe shot 29.4%, and Mirotić shot 34.1%, all from basketballreference.com. So once again, for context, the Raptors' defense really made the entire Milwaukee offense a lot more inefficient. So my point is, without Kawhi, I guess, would you think they play a lot more of Marc Gasol. Would you think Marc Gasol receives like plenty, like a ton of minutes at center this year against Milwaukee?
I mean, I don't really see why not. He's had injuries that he's been dealing with, but I mean, if he's healthy, then I don't really see why not. Considering right. He's still one of the better defenders in the NBA, especially in the paint, which is extremely important.
Right, because I think the one player on Toronto who can match Giannis, I guess, in terms of size, like Giannis is 6'11", 242, and Pascal Siakam is 6'9", 230. So I guess in terms of size and movement, that's probably the best, I guess, one-on-one matchup you're going to get against Giannis. But even then, like, was that the same strategy they used last year? And keep in mind, they had Kawhi last year. And
I think OG definitely fills Kawhi's void more than enough. And on the defensive side of the ball. On the defensive side of the ball. Just because with Kawhi, a large part of what he does defensively, he gets stops. And I think that's a large part of that. That is a large part of what OG does. I haven't like studied OG's film or anything defensively, but that is a large part of what he's so good at. It's getting those stops. So he kind of like seamlessly fits in, if that makes sense, to Kawhi's defensive void. And OG was injured for some time in the playoffs too last year.
Right. And I'm going to transition a little bit here to the offense of the Toronto Raptors, because we talked a little bit about how Milwaukee's entire offense is centered around Giannis, obviously, as their big body who can go up and get rebounds. And then they've surrounded him with shooters who can all hit from three. So let's look at the other side and talk about Toronto a little bit. How exactly do you see their offense working out in this, I guess, projection
against Milwaukee?
Yes.
Kind of interesting. I haven't really considered how their offense exactly would work out against Milwaukee. I mean, they're a good offense. They're not a great offense necessarily. And you know, they do have some shooters, right? I mean, almost every single player in that starting lineup, off the top of my head, they can space the floor. But sort of my one thing of that is that, yeah, okay, these players can all shoot. They're all, like, they're good shooters, right? But, like, you don't have, like, those players, especially considering, like, Milwaukee's rim-oriented defense. You don't have those players like Boston, because, I mean, actually, I can just read this out really quick in terms of, like, three-point percentage. Boston this year shooting what I think, or actually I Boston and Toronto are equal, about equal in 3-point percentage this year. So I'll take that back. I thought Boston was a little bit higher, but actually let me check one more thing while I'm talking. But I just don't think, like, Boston, like, all their stars, the thing with Boston, like, all their stars that can beat you in pick and roll, like Tatum, Brown obviously is on a roll from 3-point range. Hayward, I mean, you can Kemba too, obviously. They're all great shooters. With Toronto, yeah, Kyle Lowry's a good shooter. Fred VanVleet's a good shooter. They're all good shooters too. But offensively, I just don't think they have that sort of personnel. That sort of, I hate using the word star power just because I think it's such like a vague term. But I just don't think, like, they have, I guess I'll use it though. I just don't think they have the star power to really exploit that, exploit the Bucks defense as much. That makes sense.
Right, because I'm staring at the starting lineup with Kyle Lowry, Fred VanVleet, OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, and Marc Gasol. So out of those five, I don't think Toronto exactly has a quote-unquote pure scorer, a guy, I guess, who can score from anywhere. Like, for example, a Kawhi Leonard, per se. A guy who can pull up from mid-range, get to the rim, obviously take threes and make them at a high level. They don't have that crystal clear 30 points per game score. But I think how Toronto is going to get far in this Eastern Conference is by just playing defense and holding it down on that end, and then getting all their opportunities on offense, especially with Siakam and VanVleet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I think the Bucks offense will definitely be able to exploit Toronto more this year. And then, I mean, my one thing is, like, yeah, theoretically Toronto should match up really well against the Bucks, right?
Right.
Just because on, or at least on offense too. Just because, I mean, Gasol's a great shooter for a big man. Ibaka can definitely space the floor. Lowry can shoot. Obviously, Van Vliet's a great shooter, actually. I think I underrated him when I said good shooter. I mean, these are all players that are great. But I just don't think they have that sort of personnel like Boston. You don't have, like at least offensively. I don't think there's any player that can match either Kemba or Tatum on the Raptors offensively. And then even, like, with Siakam, or I guess you could say, I mean, like, even, like, Siakam and Brown, in my opinion, it's pretty close offensively. Like, I think there's a real argument to be made there, too.
Now that I guess we've talked about both these teams in context to Milwaukee, how exactly would you, I guess, put these teams against one another, the Raptors and the Celtics? Who do you have taking that series, if it happens?
I'd have to maybe think about that one a bit more, but... man. Yeah, I think the Raptors are a better team, don't get me wrong. But in a series, I think the Celtics might actually have an advantage, even though I do think the Raptors are a better team.
Right. I think Boston has a little bit more firepower on the shooting, from a shooting perspective, especially with guys like Kemba, Tatum, Brown, Hayward. Like, guys, when I said pure scorers about when talking about the Raptors a little bit earlier, I'm not saying that the Celtics have a ton of pure scorers. I'm not making that point whatsoever. What I'm saying is the Celtics have plenty of guys who can fill those roles. Like, for example, Tatum is really their quote-unquote pure scorer. He can face up, he can get to the rim, he can pull from three. And then you have guys like Brown, Smart, Hayward. Once again, guys who are lethal from mid-range, and on occasion they can hit the three. And then obviously you have Kemba, who can do it all, just like Tatum. He's just not going to give you 30 a night.
All right, and I think even Kemba might actually be their best offensive player.
Yeah, that's a fair point, actually, because I actually did not consider that.
Considering their play making, like, I mean, and like, even like Smart adds some good offensive value at times too, if he's not like jacking up shots. Which he does sometimes, but because especially with Smart, is like he's such an elite passer. If you play him in more situations where he's sort of getting teammates good looks, especially like in the lob game, he threw a number of lobs against Brooklyn, especially in like that lob game or just making like good passes. I think even he can be like pretty valuable offensively. Tice is. I'd call him an above-average three-point shooter for a big man. And then off the bench, the Celtics aren't too strong offensively outside of Cantor, who I would call one of the best offensive centers in the game, actually, a large part due to his offensive rebounding. But defensively, going back to the defense, the Celtics actually, I would call them outside of Cantor, once again, really talented on defense, looking at their personnel, especially some of their younger players this year, on defense have been talented, and especially obviously when Smart's like if he comes off the bench in some of those playoff games, I mean he's a sixth man of the year type player, and that's because he probably is the best defensive guard in the NBA.
Yeah, so I guess I see your point there with Marcus Smart kind of being the Celtics, I guess, Draymond Green, a guy who can be a very valuable presence on defense, but at the same time facilitate the offense in a timely manner. So, do you have any other overall thoughts on the Eastern Conference, or would you like to move on to the West?
I guess I would say Boston maybe beats Toronto in like 7. I think even like matchup wise they're close. Even though I do think Toronto's a better team, I just think Boston matches up a bit better. And obviously, like I think personnel wise, Lowry and FVV are both really good defenders as well. So it'll be interesting. See how that works out. I mean, of course, Raptors, just in general, they can easily get stops too. So maybe Boston won't be so effective offensively, Boston might not be so effective offensively against Toronto, but I don't think Toronto will be nearly as effective offensively as Boston will be, if that makes much sense, just because I don't think Toronto matches up particularly well against Boston's defense. So
do you see any of the teams from the Eastern Conference as, I guess, peanut gallery making any noise? I'm referring to Miami, Indiana, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, and Orlando, for example. Do you see any of those teams?
Definitely not Orlando. Definitely not Orlando. Actually, there's the game going on right now between Orlando and Philly, so we can keep a close eye on that, I guess. But, yeah, even linking back to Philly, I don't see Philly. I think a large part, obviously, is, like, their chemistry. We saw Milton and Embiid bickering, and, like, a lot of people say, oh, you know, just give them some time to figure it out. But the thing is that chemistry doesn't magically get worked out. There's a strong possibility that you play more games, and the chemistry actually becomes worse. I mean, we saw that with the Celtics last year. Your chemistry won't just magically get better. And the offensively, Philly's fit is just atrocious as well. It's disgusting, their fit. They're making players like Ben Simmons, who in other situations could be high-impact offensive players, into, at times, a big liability on the offensive side of the ball, even though Philly does still have an elite defense, or I don't know about elite, but it's a good defense for sure. Moving on to Indiana, they've performed well in the bubble without Sabonis thus far. We'll have to keep a tab on Sabonis' health, I guess. TJ Warren has obviously played out of his mind, but I mean, it's not sustainable. Nobody's shooting that is going to shoot those well splits so consistently. I just don't see them making much noise. The one team I could see making some noise is Miami, because they're such a great three-point shooting team. It's ridiculous. I think they are the best three-point shooting team accuracy-wise this year. I can just check that. Yeah, they are. And, I mean, they also have their defense this year, even though, like, on paper, it should be good. It has been a bit spotty, but I think adding Iguodala should help. Adding Crowder should help that defense as well. I think their bench depth is quite nice as well. Obviously, you have the Dragon. You have whoever's even going to come off the bench there should all fit nice. I'd assume Crowder would come off the bench come playoff time. You'd have like either, you'd have maybe like Hero coming off the bench as well, I guess depending on their starting lineup, but they definitely have good bench depth, so there's that as well. And defensively on paper they should be better than they were, in the regular season, in the first part of the season pre bubble, and I don't really see their offense regressing too much, so.
Yeah, so I guess 2 points that I kind of wanted to hit on. TJ Warren's, I guess, statistics, surface level statistics this year inside the bubble have been 53 points against Philadelphia on 69% overall shooting and a whopping 75% from three.
That's not sustainable at all.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. He only made 1 of 6 the next game from three against the Washington Wizards, but overall he shot 54% to go along with 34 points. And then 32 against the Orlando Magic as well, with 76% from the field and 4 out of 5 from three-point range. And then, so he had that impressive three-game stretch, and then it kind of tailed off against Phoenix with 35% shooting performance against the Phoenix Suns. So, do you think TJ Warren could be a high-upside playoff contributor, or do you see that as just a three-game stretch, nothing more?
I wouldn't call it three-game stretch, nothing more. I do think it's indicative, especially considering that, you know, it's been like, what, four? He's had a lot of time to train and sort of get better, I guess you could say. Just, I mean, it's not sustainable either. I mean, I could see him being like a 20-point-per-game scorer on good efficiency come postseason, which would obviously add value. Obviously, not that same 30, 40, 50-point-per-game score he's been as of late outside of the Suns game. But I could definitely see him adding value compared to where he was pre-bubble, but I just don't think that value is significant enough to knock out a team like Miami or Boston or Toronto or Milwaukee. But I would say they could knock out Philly. I do think they could knock out Philly, so.
Okay, and final point of emphasis here. We're going to talk about Ben Simmons.
Oh, sure.
And when you said, I guess he is being misused by the Philadelphia 76ers, how exactly do you mean that? Because I've heard they've moved him to power forward now. Like, how would you best use Ben Simmons? And why are the Sixers doing it incorrectly? And how?
I would just surround him with shooters because, I mean, Ben Simmons, like, he's a good passer. He's obviously a great passer, but he's not adding very much playmaking value when, obviously, first of all, he can't space the floor, which in and of itself is going to limit his playmaking value. But when you have players that are crowding the paint on the Sixers offense, such as Embiid, and having Simmons is actually forcing Embiid to space the floor more, I'd say, having those sorts of players, it's gonna hinder Simmons' potential because he doesn't have shooters. He can't just kick the ball to shooters by driving to the rim, and it makes it harder for him to drive to the rim too, just because the paint is so crowded. So, I mean, theoretically, you'd want to sort of play a Giannis type system around Simmons, which the Sixers are doing like the exact opposite of.
Right, so it's kind of what the Rockets did with Russell Westbrook, in a sense. They traded Clint Capella so that they could open more opportunities for Westbrook to just get to the rim and either finish or drive and kick, drive and kick, drive and kick, just make plays and get the ball outside the three-point line so that guys like James Harden, Robert Covington, and Jeff Green can shoot the ball, and PJ Tucker, obviously. And speaking of Westbrook, let's transition here to the Western Conference. So we've already both agreed on the fact that the LA Clippers are probably going to come out on top of the West. And let's talk about that for a quick second. Like, talk about what makes the Clippers, I guess, so great outside of Kawhi and Paul George, obviously, as their two superstars. And I guess zeroing in on Paul George specifically, do you think this is the year where he makes his presence?
Oh, sure. Okay, so obviously the big elephant in the room whenever you talk about the Clippers is the Lakers, but I guess sort of, like you said, starting specifically with the Clippers, you mentioned outside of Kawhi and Paul George, you know, who they have, like, what's their depth situation kind of like? I mean, they're just so insanely deep. Obviously, you have Lou Williams, one of the best six men in the NBA. You have Harrell, also one of the best six men in the NBA, and both of them have missed time in the bubble too, by the way. You have Pat Beverly, one of the better guard defenders in the NBA, and then you just go down the list. Also, that list is, I mean, filled with shooters that can space the floor. Morris, who hasn't been great for them so far, but or at least not in the LA games, but he'll I assume he'll pick it up. You have Morris, JaMychal Green can space the floor. Some Patrick Patterson, he can space the floor. Some Shamit can space the floor. Zubats. On the defensive side of the end, he provides some value as an interior defender. And, I mean, the list just keeps on going, and it keeps on going. And, I mean, that's just so valuable to have so many different players that can add value. And one of the things that some people like to use is that, okay, well, you know, these players are also similar. Like, they're adding repetitive value, you know. And they also like to say, like, you know, the Clippers they're too isolation heavy. They have too many ball stoppers. But my contention to that is, first of all, when all of these players are such good three-point shooters, I don't think being a three-point shooter is adding repetitive value, just because it's not like you need the ball in the hands to be effective or to add value as a shooter. You add that too by spacing. And so that'd be my contention to that. And also, the Clippers aren't that ISO heavy. Even, like, I think the Lakers might actually, like, run more ISOs per game than the Clippers. And that number might also go up now, considering they have Deion Waiters and J.R. Smith on their team. So, I mean, that'd be another point I'd like to bring up. And from three-point range, the Clippers are also, I mean, I already mentioned this, sort of, I alluded to it with the spacing, but they're nice from there too. I mean, they, like I said, they have shooters, and having shooters doesn't really add a lot of repetitive value. And then, the one other thing that people like to talk about against the Clippers, I'd say would be, oh, you know, well, they don't have playmakers. You know, they don't have the playmaking to be able to contend in the postseason. And I guess a couple points against that. Lou Williams can definitely play make well. Kawhi Leonard statistically actually has been one of the best playmakers in the NBA. However, you want to, because playmaking, the thing, it's not just playmaking, it's not just passing. You add playmaking value by also drawing defenders, whether it be for spacing, which opens the floor, your gravity, which can open the floor for some shooters, or just like your general scoring ability, or even outside of passing, your also your off-ball movement can open some abilities and open some doors. And then there's more that goes into playmaking too. I mean, you can argue for sure. And Kawhi, in terms of when you like look at all that, combine all that, he's one of the best playmakers in the NBA. You could argue even if you wouldn't call him one of the best passers necessarily. I think there's more to playmaking than passing for sure. And I guess that same logic, I don't know if it exactly applies. I mean, Kawhi's still been a really good pick and roll passer this year too. I would argue, but yeah, there's that too. And I mean, it's not even like passing wise they're a terrible team. I would say either. I don't think they're necessarily that bad as a passing team. I don't know like exactly how many like assists they rack up or whatever, per game, but I mean, once again, like assist also isn't also that great of a measure. So, there's that. Yeah, I guess those are like the three main points against the Clippers that I just would like to sort of try to debunk.
Right. So we have the Clippers winning the West, and I'm assuming your opponent against them is the Lakers. Do you have the Battle of LA in the Western
Yeah,
Conference? Is that
I would
correct?
have the Battle of LA. I don't think a team like the Rockets, I wouldn't consider them. I mean, I guess if you want, you can call them threats, but I just don't think
Yeah,
they
no,
have a very realistic
I
chance.
right. I feel like this is the one year where the West isn't actually as competitive because I think the Lakers and the Clippers are, I guess, far and away the two best teams in the West, especially in the playoffs. I mean, Kawhi has been exceptional, especially last season. And you obviously have LeBron James on the other side of LA. So you have those two teams up top, and then I guess the Nuggets, Rockets, Jazz, and Thunder, I guess that's kind of a little bit of a B tier. So let's talk about that a little bit. My two cents with Houston in general is, can Russell Westbrook deliver in the playoffs? That is the question. Because it feels like for the last three seasons, we've been saying, this is the year he'll do it, this is the year he'll do it, this is the year he'll do it. And for some reason, that elite playmaker, that excellent offensive facilitator leaves the playoffs, especially to take irrational mid-range pull-up jump shots, which he, quite frankly, doesn't make very many of. And it's kind of like what we mentioned with Marcus Smart. As long as he's not jazzing up threes and missing them, which he does at times, he's a good player. Same thing with Russell Westbrook. As long as he's primarily just getting to the rim and making that the number one priority, he can probably be an asset for the Houston Rockets. And I guess expanding outside of that, you obviously have James Harden, who definitely has something to prove. After last year's, I guess, choke against the Warriors at home, especially with Kevin Durant out, and also the prior season when Chris Paul got injured and the Rockets shot very poorly from three-point range to lose the series in Game 7. So Harden still has a lot to prove. Unfortunately, I don't think he's doing it this year. And I think his window for championship kind of ran out after that 2017 season. I don't think they're getting back at all. And with the Jazz, they just look really, really off, especially in the bubble. So I don't think the Jazz can keep up with either Houston or, for example, Denver, especially with guys like Jokic and superstars like James Harden, Russell Westbrook, all of them. Do you have any other thoughts to add on?
I mean, I think Houston's offense should be fine theoretically. I mean, they've dropped off in the postseason in the past, but I mean, I don't think I think their offense should still be really good. I think my biggest issue with them is their defense because, to put it quite frankly, their defense is like I'd call it a mediocre defense. I don't know if you want to argue it's average or it's below. It doesn't really matter. I mean, either way, it's not like one of the better defenses in the NBA. And with the Lakers and Clippers, you both have teams that you can argue are both top five offense. And I guess less with the Lakers, but also, sorry. You can argue for sure they're both a top five defense. And then you can make the argument. I would call the Clippers a top five offense. I don't know if I'd do the same with the Lakers, but I mean, I'd still call the Lakers a top 10 offense, certainly. In a team setting, theoretically, defense and offense are equal. I mean, we're not talking players here, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, Houston traded away their, I guess, only rim protector. So, obviously, their defense kind of took a dip. But when it comes to, I guess, high-impact plays in crucial situations, Robert Covington's been the guy. Like, in terms of just getting blocked shots and defending shots going straight up in the air, he's been one of the best in the league. He's always had that reputation. So, in a way, I guess it was a trade-off, especially considering how proficient he is shooting the three ball. But at the same time, Houston kind of falls flat when you're going up against teams like Denver and the Lakers with Nikola Jokic and Anthony Davis, who are both big-bodied players who like to dominate the paint area. I don't think Houston has an answer for either guy.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, Kevin's certainly a great defender, and if you want, like, any... If I would take, like, any perimeter defender to fill the void of a big man, Covington would probably be up there. But, I mean, just once again, I see their defense as, like, average to, like, mediocre. And then, I mean, some could argue, like, significantly below average. I would definitely not go there, because considering their defense actually has been pretty good in the bubble. But, I mean, obviously it's such a small sample. But, yeah, I just think, you know, defense is such... It's just so important. It's half of the game, from a team setting, and that's half of the team that half of the game where Houston is significantly behind both of the LA teams. And offensively, you can call Houston actually possibly the best out of those three. Even though I'd say in the postseason, I'd probably go the Clippers, offensively.
Right.
But like, the defense just sets them back, in my opinion.
In a way, the Clippers are kind of like the Toronto Raptors in the sense that they're not necessarily the team that's just going to blow you out, but they very much can get it done offensively and at a much higher, I guess, success rate than Toronto. But at the same time, they will play stout defense. And especially in the playoffs, where you need to contain those explosive 30-point-per-game scorers like James Harden and Russell Westbrook, the LA Clippers, with the staunch defensive lineup they have, can definitely keep those two teams in check. Can definitely keep the Houston Rockets in check.
Yeah.
That's my two cents on, I guess, that matchup per se.
Which team were you talking about again? The Rockets and
the Clippers and the Rockets.
Oh, okay, yeah. I do think the Clippers match up well against the Rockets, and yeah, that's my two cents there. So, I guess now for the big matchup, Lakers and Clippers. So, we both have Clippers, and I actually used to have the Lakers, but I just sort of thought about it more. And then, obviously, like, one big thing that, you know, Lakers proponents would say is, you know, well, look at how the two teams are doing in the regular season, which, okay, sure, the Lakers have won a good amount more games, but I would also like to mention that, I mean, if you're looking at regular season like stats, which the win loss record or the win percentage actually is a regular season stat, I don't know if win percentage is exactly the best one there. I mean, I'd look at stats like net rating as that accounts for like, obviously like, you know, were you just barely passing by in the games you won, or were you like actually like dominating, or maybe did you get unlucky in some games and like just barely lost, right? So I in like net rating, like using cleaning the glass, which I think is the most reliable for this sort of stat, the Clippers are actually ahead of the Lakers. Clippers are second, Lakers are fifth, although the margin isn't that big. And then also using Basketball Reference simple rating system, which is essentially point differential, then it basically accounts for like opponent strength. The Clippers are also ahead there. So, and obviously the Clippers have had more injuries this year, or I would say their injuries have been more significant this year and more hindering than the Lakers, probably. So, I mean, that's that. And I'm not going to say Kawhi isn't trying the regular season just because I think there's no way to possibly prove that. I just think it's false. I just think it's like, I'm not going to say if it's false or true. I just think it's just a claim, in my opinion. There's no evidence to back that up, so I'm not going to say that at all. But I think the Clippers have been more at a disadvantage in the regular season considering, like, context. And yet, statistically, if you want to say SRS and net rating matter more than win percentage and predicting, not saying, like, standings-wise, but, like, just in deciding who's the better team, obviously, you can't use stats to, like, for your whole argument. That's just ridiculous, of course. But if you were to use stats and you were to make the argument that, oh, well, the Lakers have done so much better in the regular season, I think that's a counter to that.
Yeah, I don't think regular season win-loss record is the move. Like, especially when comparing two teams who, in terms of talent on paper, are kind of, I guess, separate. I think the Clippers are quite better, especially on paper. I think the Lakers, quite frankly, their playoff fate is directly in the hands of LeBron and AD. And I know that sounds like a very obvious statement, but the reason I say that is because they've, like, when you look at the rest of the Lakers roster, there is really not that much talent around them, for example. Like, Danny Green, for example, has not played well whatsoever when it comes to play in the bubble. Danny Green has not played well. They have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who we all know takes a lot of shots and plays very, very inefficiently. Kyle Kuzma has not played well. They have Caruso, who I guess is a role player, but I don't know what he is outside of that. And they have a bunch of guys who are 6'10", 6'11", or like just a bunch of big rebounding presences who can box out in the paint. But outside of that, they don't have very many elite passers. Defense, I don't know who they really have besides AD. And I guess you can count the Shot Blockers and Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee.
I actually do have a few counters to that. This is just a specific thing. I don't think KCP really gets the rep he deserves. Just because, you know, he gets such a bad rep, and a lot of it's due to, obviously, like, the first few games of the season. But he actually has been pretty efficient this year. I think he's actually been a bit above average in terms of efficiency. So I won't knock him. And then you mentioned, like, I mean, you were obviously slanting more towards, like, how the Lakers' offense falls apart without LeBron and AD, which I would obviously agree with. But I do think they definitely have quite a few defensive pieces outside of AD, Miggy, Caruso, and Howard, which I think were those the four you mentioned. You might have mentioned someone else instead of Caruso.
Yeah, I don't quite remember who I said. Danny Green, by the way. Danny Green's a defender.
Yeah. I just don't think their defenders are truly that bad at all on the perimeter, because I'll just go down the list and I'll explain. I think that'd be easier than trying to find some arbitrary stats, but LeBron's been a great defender this year. Danny Green's has historically been a good defender. We'll see how he does. Caruso's a great defender. I would say obviously Howard, McGee, and AD are obviously great defenders. There's no debate there. If you want, you can debate it, but I would just disagree. I think they're all good defenders at the very least. Rondo, it's a bit iffy with him on the defensive side, I think you could argue, but I think obviously, like, once again, he does have the reputation of being a good defender. We'll see how far that reputation sort of carries. But if you'd like, I could bring up some statistics I think would help prove this case a bit more than just saying, I know I said I wouldn't, but I think it'd help prove this case more than just saying, you know, oh, this player's a good defender, this player's not. So,
Yeah, so we were talking about, I guess, the talent disparity between the two teams. And when you look at the Clippers, at least on the defensive end, you see guys like Patrick Beverley, Kawhi Leonard, obviously, Paul George, another great defender, Montrezl Harrell, another very solid defender. So that's, I guess, four very good or elite defensive players on that team alone. And I mean, I don't know. I just think that LA is, that the Clippers, sorry, are just more complete on both ends of, on both ends of the court. I think that advantage in terms of true on paper talent is really going to manifest on the court this year.
Yeah. I would say the Lakers have a better defense. I would say the Lakers have a better defense just because they're better more where it matters, which, I mean, the paint. I mean, I think actually, like, the, what's it called? I think the Clippers have actually maybe allowed less points in the paint this year, but I think that's an unreliable statistic. It doesn't take into account efficiency at all. I think the Lakers are better defense just because they're better where it matters, which is, like I mentioned, in the paint. But, I mean, it's not to say, like, the Clippers are still really good defense. And like I said, the Lakers, like, running through the list. KCP, though, so, I mean, I don't know if I'd call him a good defense. He's definitely neutral. Like, if that makes sense. Like, I think he's not, like, decreasing your value on defense as well. And aside, call Dudley a pretty good defender, so... I mean, the Lakers, like, almost top to bottom have some good defenders outside of some of those players they just signed.
So do you have the Clippers in seven for this series? Because I might, just because of LeBron James's greatness in the playoffs.
Honestly, I have no idea. Clippers are better on paper. Lakers probably do have a better fit offensively, but and are better defensively, but Clippers offensively, I think they... The margin's just too wide, in my opinion. I'll go Clippers and... I'll go seven. I think that's the most safe choice.
Okay, so we agree on that. Yeah. And I want to address the five teams that we... I just want to touch up a little bit on the other five teams in the Western Conference. The Nuggets, the Jazz, the Thunder, the Mavericks, and the Grizzlies, who are probably going to make the playoffs at this rate. So do you have some, I guess, thoughts on those teams specifically before we, I guess, wrap up this podcast?
So the Mavericks, you mentioned the Mavericks, correct? If I heard you correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. I think the Mavericks are definitely an underrated team. Statistically, they have the best offense this year. I wouldn't agree with the stat, but, I mean, they do have the best offense this year for talking statistically. And I would still call them a top three offense in the NBA, especially as it comes postseason time. I don't see really any reason for them to get worse, considering I wouldn't call them a super predictable offense to say. I wouldn't exactly call them a super predictable offense. So I don't really see any reason for their offense getting much worse. Or, I mean, I do think it'll decline, but I don't think it'll decline by as much as some people are saying. And, I mean, coupled with, like, obviously a really good offense of like an average-ish defense, maybe mediocre to average defense, kind of like Houston. I wouldn't put them on the same tier as Houston, I wouldn't rank them as high as Houston, but I think you can put them, like, if you have like a tier, you could put Houston at like the top of that sort of tier, and then you could put like Dallas at like the middle of that same tier. I do think Dallas is quite underrated. I think the Blazers, honestly, at this point might have the best chance of making it. I think the Blazers, there's a strong chance, first of all, Memphis falls out of the 8 seed, especially considering their schedule's pretty hard. As for Portland, I mean, having Nurkic and Collins back just makes all the difference, especially defensively, because that's mainly where they struggled this year. And Nurkic, of course, also adds a good amount of offensive value. And also Gary Trent, obviously, he's been like one of the breakout stars of the bubble. He cannot miss from three-point range. So I do think the Blazers, among that crop that are like fighting for that playoff spot for the 8 seed, I do think they're the best team. And I definitely think they have a strong chance of getting the 8 seed. And even if they do get the 9 seed, I do definitely think they have a good chance of beating the Grizzlies twice in a row. So I think the Blazers are dangerous in the postseason if they do make it. But I don't think they beat the Lakers, which if they do make it, that would be their playoff matchup. So.
Do you have any quick thoughts on the Jazz, the Thunder, or the Nuggets? Because my logic on the Jazz is, I guess they show up when they want to. And unfortunately, that wasn't last year in the playoffs for them. A lot of people had that series going to 7. Houston ended it in 5, even after some dismal shooting performances. I think Utah has kind of looked poor coming out of the bubble. Like, they've not been great at all, in my opinion. And I quite honestly think if they face any of these, any of the other teams in that tier, I guess like the Nuggets, the Rockets, and the Thunder, I don't think they stand a chance.
Yeah, I think Utah, I don't like Utah this year. Obviously, they've been injured pretty heavily recently. And, I mean, chemistry matters. I think Mitchell and I think the team as a whole actually did a good job of putting everything to the side. But I just don't think they're good enough. I just don't. I just think losing Bogdanovich hurts. And even Mitchell, Rudy, and Conley were out today against San Antonio. So I expect to monitor those injuries. I don't know quite how significant those are. But actually, I think Gobert just sat out because of rest. And he's their most valuable player, in my opinion. But I don't know, man. I just don't think Utah can really match up or stand a chance against definitely not one of those top two teams in the West. And I just think among those top seven teams, I just think they're the worst, personally. And you talked about Denver. I think Denver's pretty good. Solid offense, solid defense, but nothing too special. Even though MPJ and Bol Bol have both been playing well, especially Porter Jr. And as for OKC, I do like OKC just because they haven't been playing well, of course, since like Thanksgiving, early December sort of range. But I do think that stretch may have been a bit overrated. I don't think their net rating, I'm not sure about like in the bubble, but like, or just like from like December 1st to pre-bubble to like the last game of the season, before the bubble started, their net rating was like 7 or so in the NBA, I think. So even though like they had like what, the top 2 or 3 record in the NBA, so I do think that stretch is a bit overrated. But I would still take them over Utah and possibly even over. I don't know if I'd take them over Denver, but I think I'd take them over Utah, yeah.
Yeah, Denver, I guess Denver is kind of the wild card in this Western Conference playoff hunt. They might take the Clippers or the Lakers to 6. I doubt they will, but if Michael Porter Jr. really plays like an X factor, and then you obviously have guys like Jokic, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's going to happen. But you never know at this point.
Yeah. And I guess moving on to the last series that we could talk about, that would be the finals. Bucks and Clippers. Okay. So who would you have there? And I'll just say right away who I would have. I would take the Clippers pretty much for the same reason that I had the Boston Celtics matching up pretty well against the Bucks offensively, because they have stars who can space the floor, but the Clippers just amplify that. So, yeah. What, anything to say there, at least for you?
I quite frankly agree with you. I think if this series is going to end, it's the kind of series that's going to end on a Kawhi Leonard buzzer beater in Game 7. Straight up. I think these teams are too close for it not to go to late in the fourth quarter in Game 7. Like, you have, like, the Bucks are by far the best team in the East, and the Clippers are arguably the best team in the West, but when it comes to performing in the playoffs, the Clippers have a much better track record than the Bucks. Like, Kawhi had a postseason for the ages last year, and I guess the entire wild card within the Clippers itself is whether or not this is a year for Paul George to break out and show the NBA that he truly is that superstar who truly is that playoff superstar we've all equated him to in the past couple of seasons. I know 2017 and 2018 weren't too great, especially because he was playing with Russell Westbrook on the Thunder, and once again that inefficient play style Westbrook develops for some reason in the playoffs of selfishness. So I think if the Clippers are going to win the series, Paul George is probably going to have to take over some of these games. And I mean, like, really. We might be looking at 30-point nights from both of them, both him and Kawhi.
I don't necessarily think, I just think all that really matters to Paul George is he has to be efficient. He's been really on and off in the postseason the past year or two. But I obviously he's had a shoulder injury and he's healthy now and he's been looking pretty good when you watch the games. So I think, I mean, if he can just be efficient, if he can just do his thing, add scoring value, of course, add defensive value, space the floor. I think that should definitely be serviceable enough for sure. And I agree. I think it goes at least 6 or 7. Yeah, I mean, I think both, I would probably take both the Clippers and Bucks over the Lakers. But ultimately, I would take the Clippers, and I'll agree with you. I'll say 7. I don't have a definitive answer, of course, for mounting games, just because that's really subjective and hard to predict. But even the series actually is. But I'd go Clippers in 7. So any last thoughts?
And then I think a lot of Milwaukee's struggles against the Clippers are going to be going up against a team with players who have, I guess, competed at a high level this late in the playoff stage. Like, you obviously have Kawhi, and they're coached by Doc Rivers, for example. But if you go to the other side of the equation, Mike Budenholzer, in his time with the Atlanta Hawks, did not reach an NBA Finals game. I mean, heck, weren't the Bucks supposed to dominate everyone last year and reach the finals that way? They hit a brick wall against the Toronto Raptors, and whether or not Budenholzer can overcome that slump, along with guys like Giannis, Middleton, and Bledsoe, along with the hopes of those guys having a better series than they did last year, I think the Bucks' fate entirely resides on that. On whether or not those guys can step up.
I just think the Bucks have to shoot better from the... Honestly, if they just shoot well, I think they'll be fine against Toronto. This year, at least. And, yeah, I mean, it's tough. Going back to Milwaukee and Clippers, I mean, it's tough, but I just have to get the Clippers. I think... I think they just match up better. I mean, you can argue the Bucks are a better team on paper. You could go the Clippers. In actuality, you could go the Bucks. I just think the Clippers might match up a little bit better. But even though, actually, another thing that I kind of forgot to think about, I should have thought of this, was that who's stopping Giannis? Because Zubats, he's a good defender. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, he's not stopping Giannis. He's not mobile enough. Harrell's undersized, but. I mean, if you just let Giannis have his and you just go off offensively, or at least try as hard as you can against the Clippers, or sorry, against that really good Bucks defense, and I do think the Clippers match up well, I think the Clippers can pull it out, so give me Clippers.
Yeah, I guess the Bucks definitely have the advantage at the rim, mainly because of the Lopez twins and obviously Giannis. But I think in terms of shooting the basketball, I feel like the Clippers have an unfair advantage everywhere else in terms of from three-point range, from mid-range, wherever. Just taking pure jump shots, I think the Clippers can win the series doing just that.
Sure. Okay, so unless you have any final things, I think that just about wraps it up. So we both have the Clippers and Bucks in the finals. We're both taking the Clippers in 7. And we both have Clippers over Lakers in 7, and I guess that's sort of a summary. So to summarize a few more things, we both kind of like the Celtics in terms of their matchups against some of those East teams, but we still think the Bucks are beating them. And on the West side of things, I don't think either of us are too high on the Jazz, and we're both somewhat conflicted on Houston, I guess you could say. I mean, we both think Houston has a good offense. I think I might be a little bit higher on their offense than you are, but then once again, like, the defense, so.
Right, so that about wraps it up. Thank you very much for listening to the Up in the Air Sports Podcast. This was our pilot. We really hope you guys enjoy it. And that's that.
All right. Thank you.